away from the biggest elephant in the room, from what we, what, you know, our country as the second highest polluter in the world.
Do you think climate change is a national emergency?
Yes, I thoroughly believe so, and I believe that scientists across the nation and the world also agree with me.
Alyssa Chen, I want to thank you for being with us. 18-year-old senior at Bronx High School of Science. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the world premiere of Jump, co-produced by Confrontation Theater and the Milagro Theater. The play runs from March 21st through April 13th at the Milagro Theater in Portland. Jump is the story of a 20-something who is reeling from the death of her mother. She is looking for solace in a good place to vape, but what she finds is a journey of self-discovery. Again, that's Jump. Every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday from March 21st through April 13th at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO. Time is 5 o'clock, and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Up next is the evening news. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Cotton Cloud Natural Beds and Furniture, woman-owned since 1981. Providing sustainable wood furniture, locally handcrafted futons, latex mattresses, and more, using organic and natural materials. The Cotton Cloud showroom is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. More information can be found online at cottoncloudfutons.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
McNamee, author of the new book Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe.
Middle School Kids Riot in Vancouver.
And in international news, mourners in New Zealand are turning in their guns. They don't want them anymore.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News from Monday, March 18th, 2019. I'm Ray Bodwell.
And I'm Ken Jones. School officials trying to remove a student from the gym at Geyser Middle School in Vancouver touched off a riot Friday afternoon. The struggle started when school officials tried to remove a student from the gym during a basketball tournament. The teachers were surrounded and attacked by dozens of students. Then, when police arrived, the group surrounded the officers. A spokesman for Vancouver police said the students were shouting the N-word and making death threats at the school officials and the sheriffs. 9 of the brawling teenagers were arrested. Officials said it took more than 30 officers from 3 different agencies to get the situation under control. A neighbor who witnessed the fight said officers were slamming kids into walls and throwing them into cars. The youth were charged with trespassing, failure to leave, assault, disorderly conduct, and resisting arrest. School officials today confirmed that all the arrested students have been expelled.
Last August, Portland Police Chief Danielle Outlaw met with FBI Director Christopher Wray. The meeting came before the February decision by the Portland City Council to withdraw from the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force. However, the contents of the meeting have not been released, and Police Bureau Records Supervisor Tammy Weiss said first that no documents of the meeting existed. She then admitted that several photos of the meeting were taken, and finally that neither Police Chief Outlaw or Director Ray had been asked to collect their emails pertaining to the meeting. A police spokesman with the Portland Bureau said that a records request must be filed and that no information about the meeting would be released without a request. The only documentation that's been released is a photo of Police Chief Outlaw and Director Ray smiling and shaking hands.
Millions of gallons of water flooded part of the affluent Alberta Arts neighborhood Saturday afternoon. A 100-year-old water main burst at Northeast 23rd and Skidmore Avenues, flooding the streets, businesses, and the basements of nearby houses. Buildings from Northeast 25th to Northeast 31st Avenue were affected. A Water Bureau spokeswoman said the rupture was probably caused by old pipes freezing and thawing this winter. The water flowed for hours and the power was out for 10,000 electrical customers until about 5 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. Fei Ren Chang, owner of Just Bob's Cafe, told the Oregonian, "It came down the street and it was just like a wall of water. We're lucky we're built a little higher."
A 19-year-old has decided to sue the Westland City Council president for refusing to honor a public records request. Rory Bialasteski, a senior last year at Westland High School, started attending local council meetings to learn more about parking restrictions around his high school. The teen filed two public records requests to view handwritten notes made during the meetings by the council president, Terry Cummings. He first requested the notes from the city and then the council president. Both were denied. The public records entry in the Westland City Council rules recently adopted in October 2018, quote, "Written information incidental to the official duties of a member of the city council are subject to disclosure under the Oregon Public Records Law." In other Oregon records news, Senate Bill 609, which adds the stipulation that the requests must disclose what they intend to do with the information received, was withdrawn by its sponsor in January after an outcry by local media outlets.
In the wake of the murders in Christchurch, New Zealand, a number of mourners there have surrendered their weapons to be destroyed by police. One farmer who gave up his weapons said that, "Once you accept these guns can be harmful in the wrong hands, the trade-off is a small inconvenience. It's not a big deal not having my gun anymore." On the other hand, in St. Louis, Missouri, a gun store owner declared that the shooting was something great. He then put up an online poll on Facebook. Before the poll was taken down, 15% of the people who responded believed the shooting was something to be celebrated.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on a successful labor drive for workers at Little Big Burger. At 6, it's Labor Radio, and at 6:30, it's Making Contact. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight will be clear with a low around 46, windy with an east wind of 23 to 26 miles an hour with gusts as high as 40 miles an hour. Tomorrow will be sunny with a high near 70, and the winds will continue. Today in history, in the year 37, the Roman Senate proclaimed Caligula emperor, and in 1969, President Richard M. Nixon authorized Operation Menu, the secret bombing of Cambodia. The bumper sticker of the day is from the KBOO newsroom, quote, "We don't want to take away your guns, we want you to put away your guns," end quote.
In the first 24 hours of former Congressman Beto O'Rourke's presidential campaign, he raised $6.1 million. Beto turned to fundraising after refusing to take any money from political action committees. Other Democratic candidates, including Senator Bernie Sanders, have also turned to fundraising for their campaigns. Sanders raised $5.9 million in the first 24 hours of his campaign last month. Sanders reached $10 million within the first 5 days. Of the other candidates, Senator Kamala Harris raised $1.5 million, Senator Amy Klobuchar raised $1 million in 48 hours, and Senator Elizabeth Warren raised around $300,000 on the first partial day of her campaign.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Construction on the Keystone XL pipeline remains on hold as an appeal to the Ninth Circuit plays out. That order came out Friday. The pipeline was stopped late last year when a federal judge put an injunction on the project until the U.S. State Department does more work on the permit. TransCanada had asked that the injunction be lifted while the appeal proceeds. Victoria Wicks has more.
TransCanada has said in court filings that it needs to start building worker camps by March 15th to make the spring construction season. The company asked the Ninth Circuit to issue an interim order lifting the injunction by that date. Environmentalists are celebrating the appeals court's decision. Jackie Prang, a senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council, plaintiffs in one of the lawsuits filed in Montana federal court.
The pipeline certainly should not be built before TransCanada has all of its permits and when a lower court has found it that the State Department violated the law.
Prang says parties will now file briefs over the spring and summer, and the Ninth Circuit will consider the issue after that. TransCanada has issued a written comment saying the company is assessing the decision and considering its options moving forward. Plaintiffs include a number of environmental and indigenous groups. Rosebud Sioux Tribe and Fort Belknap Indian Community are seeking to intervene on just one issue, the legality of the State Department's administrative process. I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Despite legal setbacks leading up to the 2018 midterm elections in North Dakota, tribes and voting rights advocates hope they can overturn a state voter ID law they say threatens voting for tribal members. Christine Trudeau has a second part in our series on Native voting rights in North Dakota.
She cooked up a special dinner, so she invited a bunch of people. Manoodle.
Standing Rock Sioux tribal member Terry Yellowfat is a retired teacher, and for our interview, we take shelter on a cold, windy Sunday afternoon in a car parked in front of his house. Terry has lived in this house in Fort Yates, North Dakota, for decades. Most of those years, he's used a post office box as his primary address, until recently, when his tribe issued him a street address for emergency response purposes. But that didn't line up with what state election officials had on file.
The address that, when I look it up, that they're using now belongs to the local liquor store, bar. And I was upset with that because I never drank in my life. And here I am, I'm listed as a liquor store.
The experience prompted Yellowfat to join a lawsuit with the Spirit Lake Tribe, saying the North Dakota law requiring a physical address in order to cast a ballot infringes on their constitutional right to vote. Jacqueline DeLeon, an attorney from the Native American Rights Fund, says even though the Supreme Court would not block the law before the last election, the fact that the law's disproportionate harm to many other Native voters like Yellowfat remains clear.
We still know that there are hundreds of people, potentially thousands of people out there that still don't have an ID. You know, there was a tremendous push this election, but we don't know and are skeptical that if the law remains on the books, people will have IDs going forward in the future.
DeLeon says the surprisingly large number of voter turnout last November was fortunate, but in the end, voters deserve a permanent solution to laws that erect barriers to their basic constitutional right, which is why NARF is continuing their legal challenges.
Everybody was incredibly fired up about turnout, and you know, there was lines out the door, there were extended hours, and it just showed how many people did not have an ID going into the election.
NARF is confident in their suit moving forward, and Terry Yellowfat remains vigilant looking ahead to the 2020 election.
I am going to step forward again, even if it takes another court case.
I'm Christine Trudeau.
This story is a collaboration with the Solutions Journalism Network and Prairie Public Broadcasting. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
For Native Americans affected by domestic violence, the Strong Hearts Native Helpline offers peer-to-peer support and resources. It's safe, confidential, and toll-free at 844-7-NATIVE. Program support by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center. Support by PrairieEdge.com, where you'll find a variety of buffalo items like robes, skulls, rattles, and drums. Serving the Native American community for over 36 years, located in Rapid City or online at PrairieEdge.com. Wopila.
Colorado is the newest state to pass a law requiring that its electoral college votes must be given to the political candidate who wins the popular vote. Governor Jared Polis last Friday signed the new law, which advocates say puts more power into the hands of voters. Colorado's new law only takes effect if enough other states pass similar laws to create a critical mass, allowing them to win the total 270 electors needed to elect a president. Most states have winner-take-all systems. Colorado's votes raise the current total to 181 electors. So far, the national popular vote interstate compact includes California, Connecticut, Hawaii, Illinois, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, Rhode Island, Vermont, and Washington State, as well as the District of Columbia and now, of course, Colorado. New Mexico also sent a bill to its governor's desk to elect the president by popular vote and may soon join the group. In 2016, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, but Donald Trump won more Electoral College delegates.
About a year ago, Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross offered to add a question to the 2020 Census questionnaire asking about citizenship. The census is supposed to count all residents, and there's concern that some undocumented residents may be reluctant to answer the citizenship questions, which would render the census inaccurate. A recent study looks forward to examine what actual effect the citizenship question may have, especially what effect it would have on congressional apportionment. Estimating the shift of population throughout the U.S., the study suggests there should be a net change of 9 seats in the House of Representatives. Some states would gain and some would lose. For example, without the question, Texas and Arizona would gain representation, but with the question, they would lose. This conclusion is based on the number of undocumented residents who might not be counted in the census. While this is not exactly gerrymandering, it has a similar effect at the national level. The full story behind this can be found at theconversation.com.
Today's the deadline for the Los Angeles Unified School District to prove it can pay all its bills without going into debt. It's not clear if the nation's second largest school district can do it. Michelle Wiley and Saul Gonzalez have more from the California Report.
The Los Angeles Unified School District is dealing with the fallout of its own teacher strike earlier this year. Today is the deadline for the district to prove its fiscal solvency, that it can pay all of its bills without going into debt. And it's not clear if the nation's second largest school district can do it. KCRW's Saul Gonzalez has more.
We are the teachers!
We are the teachers!
January's LA teacher strike ended with instructors getting a 6% salary hike and a pledge by the district to hire more school staff and cut class sizes. But that $400 million deal made the LAUSD's already terrible financial situation worse, and bankruptcy looms within 3 years. In the long term, the LAUSD hopes to get more money from Sacramento and place a parcel tax on the local ballot, with funds raised going to schools. But today, the district has to submit a financial plan to LA County's Office of Education. Jim Morris works at that office.
The law in California requires school districts to be able to show and prove to the County Office of Education you can pay your bills.
The plan the LAUSD submits has to prove the district won't go broke and do so without relying on money it doesn't have yet, like state revenue or funds from a parcel tax. But if the school district hands in a plan that isn't up to snuff, the county could take an extraordinary action, appointing a financial advisor with the power to make budget decisions for the district, including cuts. Again, Jim Morris.
Ultimately, the county superintendent has that authority. That's correct.
When contacted for a response, the LAUSD released a statement saying the district will submit a plan on time and it will include cuts. One more thing. If both LA Unified and LA County can't find a solution to the district's financial troubles, there is a kind of nuclear option. The state could step in, fire top school management, and seize control of LAUSD. For the California Report, I'm Saul Gonzalez in Los Angeles.
Coal plants are changing the weather. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report about water.
Coal plants are changing the weather. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Much of the West is covered by pine forests, but when those trees are struck by wildfire, they might not grow back, according to a new study.
Kimberly Davis at the University of Montana and her colleagues studied forests from the Sierras to the Rockies to see how they recovered after fires. They concluded that Douglas fir and ponderosa pine will have a difficult time rooting and thriving because climate change raises temperatures and creates creates hotter, drier air and soil.
Davis told Inside Climate News that the warmer and drier conditions aren't harming mature trees, but they are preventing future generations from growing.
But there are other problems for forests beside wildfires. Anthony Swift of the Natural Resources Defense Council said that intensive logging, cutting trees for power lines, and road building weakens the ability of forests to deal with stressors like climate change.
A new study shows that modern coal-fired power plants and refineries produce enormous amounts of fine dust particles, and that pollution is changing the weather.
The paper published in the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society concludes that filtration systems on modern coal plants are the largest source of microscopic dust particles, which can impact rainfall patterns on a local to regional scale.
One of the researchers, Professor George Hacker from Airborne Research Australia, told the Weather Channel that fossil power stations massively influence meteorological processes and may cause extreme weather events, including intense rainstorms. This can lead to drier than usual conditions in other places.
Ultrafine particles are microscopic, about 100 nanometers or 80 times smaller than a red blood cell. They can have enormous impacts on human health. Long-term exposure to these particles has been associated with death from heart disease, and another study recently showed how ultrafine particles inhaled by pregnant women may affect fetal cardiovascular systems.
Plastic foam cups and food containers, some made under the brand name Styrofoam, are being phased out by a few fast food chains and have been banned in many cities, including New York, Seattle, Los Angeles, and San Francisco.
Last week, the Maryland legislature passed a bill that, if signed by the governor, would make it the first state in the country to prohibit the foam products.
A spokesperson for an organization called Trash Free Maryland said that the foam absorbs toxins faster than other plastics, is mistaken for food by marine life, and is difficult to clean up.
Toxins have also been found to be transmitted by another type of plastic called nurdles, lentil-shaped plastic pellets that are the building blocks for things like televisions to single-use water bottles.
A study from the University of Stirling showed that the nurdles get into the sea by accidentally spilling from shipping containers.
Lead author Richard Quillam told The Guardian that dangerous sewage pathogens and agricultural runoff have been found hitchhiking on nurdles, which have washed up on some of Scotland's beaches.
Scientists are concerned that the phenomenon could have far-reaching implications for human health. For example, Dr. Quillam said that cholera in India could wash up on U.S. shores, since plastic is designed to not break down and could float long distances on ocean currents.
Meanwhile, at a UN conference in Kenya last week, environmental organizations accused the U.S. of blocking a proposal to fight plastic litter in the oceans.
David Azule of the Center for International Environmental Law said that the vast majority of countries agreed to develop a vision for global plastic governance, and it was disheartening to see that the U.S., guided by the interests of the fracking and petrochemical industry, was leading efforts to sabotage it.
Dams on rivers can have highly destructive effects on coastlines and their habitats.
New research from the Scripps Institution at UC San Diego examined four rivers in Mexico, two dammed to produce electricity and two free running.
They found that coastal areas shrunk along the mouths of the rivers that were dammed, affecting vital ecosystems like mangrove forests and fish habitat.
The dams trapped more than 1 million tons of sediment that led to coastlines receding at the mouths of the rivers. In contrast, for the two rivers that were free-flowing, the shorelines were stable and showed sediment growth.
According to the study, which was published in the journal Science Advances, another downside to damming rivers is the increased release of carbon that had been stored in the sediments. The authors conclude that while hydroelectric dams are championed as a source of renewable energy, the damages they cause are rarely calculated. And finally, the bomb cyclone that cut across the Plain States last week brought hurricane-force winds, blizzard conditions, heavy rain, and thunder snow as it moved northeast across the country. In its wake, there were numerous power outages, flight cancellations, stranded motorists, and devastating floods, the worst in half a century.
The Weather Channel reports that record rainfall and melting snow led to emergency declarations in Nebraska, Iowa, and Wisconsin.
Nebraska has been hit especially hard, with nearly every part of the state dealing with rising water, in some cases creating islands where the National Guard has been called in to make rescues.
James Wilkie was killed after his tractor was carried away by floodwaters while he attempted to rescue a stranded motorist. USA Today reports that nearly 900 people had been stranded inside temporary shelters.
The bomb cyclone was caused by a bombogenesis, a term used to describe when pressure drops dramatically in a short period of time, at least 24 millibars over 24 hours. It's rare for the bombogenesis to happen inland. As NOAA explains, they usually occur when a cold air mass collides with a warm air mass over warm ocean waters.
Last week's extreme event was fueled by warm, moist air from the Gulf of Mexico colliding with cold air from the north. Michael Mann, climate scientist at Penn State University, told the Huffington Post that there is evidence that climate change is increasing the conditions that support development of more intense bomb cyclones.
This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Water Works Association. Explore new trends in technology at ACE 19, June 9th through 12th in Denver. Learn more at awwaace.org.
A massive petroleum fire is burning in Houston, Texas. The fire started yesterday morning at a storage facility, and it may burn for two more days. Firefighters say that it cannot be put out. The fuel has to burn off, and all they can do is wait. Meanwhile, the fire is sending toxic smoke across the city. Residents are asked to take shelter at home, and at least two schools have been shut down. Also on Sunday morning in Los Angeles, a tanker truck carrying 9,000 gallons of gasoline sprung a leak that spilled into storm drains. It ignited an explosion. One residence was burned, and two people were injured by flames that shot out of manhole covers.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo will be deciding on the construction of a $1 billion natural gas pipeline from Pennsylvania to New York City. The pipeline would carry fracked gas from Pennsylvania through New York Harbor and into the city. The pipeline is meant to switch the city off of heavier polluting oils, but environmentalists with groups like the Sane Energy Project say that this is a step backwards for the state to take. The 23-mile pipeline would make it more expensive for companies to invest in renewable energy like wind and solar power. Climate advocates with the group 350.org released a report refuting the assertions made by the pipeline building firm Williams and National Grid, the natural gas supplier for the area. Governor Cuomo has given his support to the recent Green New Deal proposals, but his administration must make the decision on the construction of the pipeline.
A new report of economists in the U.S. found that sexual assault, harassment, and racism is hampering the careers of women and people of color in the field. The American Economic Association polled 9,000 economists. Of that group, 100 female economists said they had been sexually assaulted by a colleague, and nearly 200 said they had been, quote, almost assaulted. According to the New York Times, half of all the women who responded to the survey said they had been treated unfairly, but only 3% of men did. Half of all women surveyed also said they had stopped themselves from speaking at a conference or seminar to avoid, quote, disrespectful treatment or harassment. The Times reported that just 14% of black economists surveyed felt, quote, respected in the field. The association says part of the solution is to hire a mediator to whom victims can report crimes of sexual abuse and racism.
The guardian of a 17-year-old girl in state care has filed a lawsuit accusing the Oregon Department of Human Services, a child welfare caseworker, a foster home certifier, and their supervisor of negligence. According to the lawsuit, the girl was subject to neglect and repeated acts of sexual abuse, including rape. The legal action seeks up to $4.5 million in damages. The suit alleges the defendants failed to monitor the girl's safety and well-being while in the state's care between 2012 and 2015. According to the Oregonian, the lawsuit was filed because, quote, there are lots of minors living in a broken system and being abused, and there's nobody that's accountable for it, end quote. Currently, Oregon's Child Welfare Agency faces up to 8 additional pending lawsuits on behalf of children in similar circumstances.
In a New Yorker profile of Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg last September, Evan Osnos writes, "If Facebook were a country, it would have the largest population on Earth, more than 2.2 billion people, about a third of humanity, log in at least once a month. That user base has no precedent in the history of American enterprise. 14 years after it was founded, in Zuckerberg's dorm room, Facebook has as many adherents as Christianity." But there's a dark side to that extensive success. Our next guest, Roger McNamee, is author of the new book, Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe, from Penguin Press. And he's joining us by phone live from New York City to talk about the origins of Facebook and what it's become. Roger, thanks very much for calling in. Welcome to KBOO.
Hey, Ken, it's a pleasure. KBOO is one of my favorites. I visited you lots of times because in my band, Moon Alice, we play in Portland and stop by from time to time when we're there. So it's very exciting to be on the phone with you.
And I am excited to have you on the phone. Not only the book, but I'm also a big fan of Moon Alice. In fact, in your role of rock musician, I've seen the band several times, but of more relevance to the book, you're also a longtime tech venture capitalist going on 35 years. In that role, how did you first get involved with Facebook, and what were your first impressions of Mark Zuckerberg?
So I first met him in 2006. He was 22. The company was 2 years old. And it's, so imagine, this is less than a year after the end of the period described in the Social Network movie. So he's still super young. I got an email from a guy who worked with him who said, my boss is facing a crisis. He needs to talk to somebody who's been around a long time, who's trustworthy, and is objective. Would you take a meeting with him? And I was convinced at that time, even though Facebook was really brand new, it had practically no revenue, it was still just your picture, your name and address, and your relationship status. So there was no news feed. It was nothing like the current product. But I was convinced that because he required real identity, you had to be a student using your school email account. And because he gave you control of your privacy setting, I thought that those were the kind of the magic jelly beans, if you will, that were going to allow him to build the first social network that didn't get overrun by trolls. And so when I first met him, All I can tell you is I had a very positive view, and I was able to help him that day, and that began a three-year period where I was one of his mentors. And my experience with him was fantastic. I mean, he was not, you know, your average person at all. He was socially awkward, but brilliant and idealistic. And in those days, the Mark that I knew was somebody that I admired and liked very much. I didn't see any of the sort of ruthlessness that's depicted in the movie, although I now know that that was there also. It just was never evident in my relationship with him. And so I became a huge fan. I eventually, you know, more than a year later, became an investor in the company on behalf of my fund. And it was the sort of thing where you know, I had a relationship that caused me to be a fan and to help him through some hard moments, but then to sit back, begin 2009, I was no longer involved day to day. And so I just sat back and watched the success, was very proud of it, until 2016, when I began to notice some things going on that really scared the crap out of me, that were really inconsistent with what I had thought was the philosophy and value system of Facebook.
Oh, Roger, I just wanted to talk a little bit more about those early days before we get to that.
Yeah, go for it.
You mentioned his idealism, and he was quoted as saying the goal of Facebook is to make the world a more open and connected place, which sounds very idealistic. Was that the initial mission statement at the startup stage?
Yeah, no, I mean, I always had the impression that he wanted to connect everybody who was online in the English-speaking world, right? And, you know, I had in my mind, imagine I'm doing this in my Dr. Evil voice. He was 100 million people, right? And, you know, in my mind, that would have been enormous, and it would have been very powerful. And I think he could have done that while maintaining the strict discipline on identity and privacy. But what happened was that it became very clear to him, in a way that I did not understand in those days, that if he relaxed the restrictions on identity and privacy, he was going to be able to grow a lot faster and go a lot further. And I remember in roughly 2009 warning him that going for 1 billion users was going to take him to places that he shouldn't want to go and force him to do things he shouldn't want to do. But I was on my way out, so I wasn't really in a position to help him manage through that. And, you know, now that I look back on it, that bothers me. And the reason I became an activist was in part that I felt like this was something I'd been involved in.
Yeah, and I don't want to
I take you on that journey of discovery, that journey which I characterize as being a little bit like the Jimmy Stewart character in Rear Window. You know, I see something that looks like a crime scene, but at the beginning I know nothing. In fact, if anything, I just know positive stuff, but I pull on the thread. And the book is really takes you on that journey of discovery. You don't need to know anything about technology. And by the time you're done, you know everything you need to know. Plus, I then help you understand how to protect yourself, how to protect your children, the kind of messages you should be taking to your elected representatives to ensure that they do what's necessary to.
Now, again, in those early days, and I don't blame you for this, but the problem with Facebook was what's called monetizing you know, all their users at the time. And you were instrumental in getting the person hired who I think was mainly responsible for that new business strategy.
No, that's true.
That was Sheryl Sandberg, of course, who's currently Facebook's chief operating officer. She was tasked.
And you have to go back in those days. Sheryl was amazing. When I first met her, she was working with Bono. She was at the Treasury Department. She was the chief of staff to the Secretary of the Treasury, and she was helping to forgive the debt of emerging countries around the world that were, you know, had basically been loaned money under terms they couldn't pay back. And by forgiving the debt, she was going to give all of those countries a chance to start again. It was incredibly laudable. And you have to understand, that's the context in which I met her. She and Bono working together to help relatively poor countries get started again. And so, you know, for both her and for Mark, I knew them as idealistic people trying to make a positive impact on the world. And, you know, I think it's simply true that sometimes too much success can undermine your values. And I think that happened to the two of them.
Now, she was responsible, again, for that business strategy. There's a recent book called The Rise of Surveillance Capitalism by Shoshana Zuboff. She calls Sheryl Sandberg the Typhoid Mary of surveillance capitalism. I wonder if you could explain to the listeners bit about surveillance capitalism.
Shoshana Zuboff is a genius, okay? And the book, which is really huge, it's a doorstop, but if you're the kind of person like me who really wants to understand these problems, it's really worth it. It's truly brilliant. Her basic notion is this, that Google had an insight in 2002 that when it was doing what marketers always do, which is gather data from users in order to improve the product that you give to those users. And they were doing that, but they discovered that the search engine threw off lots and lots of interesting data that had nothing to do with improving search. So they did a lot of work to see what it was useful for. And they discovered it had value for predicting behavior across large populations of people. The notion was that you could look at search behaviors of the people on Google and figure out, wow, similar people are going to behave in similar ways over time. And so that caused them to basically realize that the more data they had, the better the predictions would be. So much more data would produce much better predictions. So they create Gmail. And Gmail was cynical two ways. First, because it gave them identity to tie to the purchase intent of search. But they decided to set it up so that they could read all the messages, and people let them do that. People who use Gmail, Google has these computers that scan everything you're doing, looking for, you know, keywords for, you know, that would signal your purchase intent or your behavioral changes. And, you know, take pictures of all the public spaces known as streets and all the private spaces known as our homes. And they simply declare, we own all this content, this data, we're going to make a market in it. Then they take our pictures of our houses from the top, which is what they call satellite view, and then they get in our faces with Google Glass, and they take pictures up close. And they simply declare all of these things are now market. We're going to gather all this data and use it to make predictions about each and every one of us. And that marketplace that Google created was something they hid from the whole world. They pretended as though they were doing something very different, that their only goal was to make their ads work better. And in fact, what they were also doing was using filter bubbles, which is when you give people only what they want, and recommendation engines, which tell people, you know, if you like this, you might like that. They took those things and twisted them so that they could make those behavioral predictions come true more often, make them more valuable. And that was incredibly cynical, incredibly dangerous, and that was something that at the time I just didn't see. And Zuboff wrote a book about that whole business model. And when Sheryl went from Google, where she was responsible for growing their advertising business, to Facebook, where she was responsible for creating an ad business, she took that idea from Google to Facebook. And it took Facebook a long time to figure out how to get it to work. It didn't work at Facebook until 2013, which was sadly 4 years after I stopped being involved. So I feel like an idiot now. At the time, I didn't see this, right? And when I talk about being Jimmy Stewart, just like, you know how Jimmy Stewart at the beginning of Rear Window, he's like, no idea what he's seeing. And you sit there and go, wait a minute, that's your neighbor. You should know what's going on. But I was a little bit like that. Just, I was an idiot. And
Roger. The subtitle, of course, is Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. And you were mentioning before that it was the turning point was about the run-up to the 2016 election when you woke up to that catastrophe.
Yeah. First, I saw in January and February 2016, during the New Hampshire primary for the Democrats, a bunch of my friends, initially just one, and then every day more people were sharing photographs with text on them, you know, what they call internet memes, depicting Hillary Clinton in various deeply misogynistic things. And they were all coming from a group that was ostensibly tied to the Bernie Sanders campaign. And it was the kind of stuff that no campaign was going to do putting their fingerprints on. And yet the thing was growing in terms of the number of people spreading these memes so rapidly, it suggested to me that someone was spending money to recruit my friends into this group. And that I thought was really weird and kind of evil. And then that was January and February. Then in March, Facebook expelled a group that was using the advertising tools to gather data about people who expressed an interest in Black Lives Matter. And they were selling that data to police departments, which was really, really evil. And so major civil rights violation. Then in June, I saw Brexit, which was the United Kingdom's referendum on leaving the European Union, where it appeared to me that Facebook's advertising tools were essentially enabling a campaign that had a really emotionally charged, kind of inflammatory message to get much better essentially cost of distribution than a campaign with a neutral message, because in that one the Leave campaign was very xenophobic and the Remain campaign was saying, hey, we got a great deal, stay the course. There was like no emotion in it at all. Then in October, the final straw for me was the Department of Housing and Urban Development cites Facebook for advertising tools that allowed discrimination in housing. And that happened, I believe, either the same week or a couple days before we got the news that the Russians were interfering in the election.
Oh, and Roger, I have to cut you off. I'm afraid we're running out of time. And also, you're in the middle of an event, I know, in New York City. It was very generous of
no
you.
No worries. I'm going to be at Powell's on Sunday night, 7 o'clock, and I hope people will come out. I'll tell more stories. I'll answer your questions. I'll help you protect your kids. So it's at Powell's Bookstore in Portland, and I hope everybody will come out because this is an important issue. And politically, we have the power to make the change, that this could be the issue of 2020. It's a right versus wrong, not a right versus left kind of issue.
Well, Roger, again, thanks so much for joining us at KBOO, and we'll see you next Sunday.
Talk to you soon.
We've been talking with Roger McNamee, author of the new book, Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe, from Penguin Press. Roger will be reading from and discussing Zucked at Powell's Books in downtown Portland next Sunday, March 24th at 7:30 p.m.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 18th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Melinda Wolfer, Carissa Bahush, Tammy Harbateas, Aiden Meyer, and August Norgren. The producer is Jim Thompson, and our engineer is Danielle Parks. The Interim Director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast and a transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 Hood River on K220 Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm. I'm Ray Bodwell.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Abe and Joe cover politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener comments. At 9, Alternative Radio talks to Professor of History Ilan Pappe about the shift in public conversation about Palestine. At 10, it's Flashpoints with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Stage and Studio and Art Focus have the day off for a Peace, Love, and Soup special that focuses on Irish stew, soda bread, and growing up in a Boston Irish family. All of this KBOO programming is made possible by you, members. If you're not a member and you'd like to become one, go to kboo.fm and click on the button marked Donate. Good night, Ray. Good night, Danielle.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Danielle.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Last Saturday, Little Big Burger employees gathered to publicly announce their union and give management their list of demands. KBOO's Tammy Habteas was there to report.
My name is Tammy Habteas, and last Saturday, I joined Little Big Burger employees as they gathered at Cooch Park to publicly announce their unionization under the name Little Big Union.
We're trying to make a good impression on the community as we launch this union. So we're not going to be trying to block people from going in. What we want to be doing is spreading the word about the union, letting people know that we're here, letting people know that we're proud to be here, not blocking the entrance. There's a lot of people here, so if we're having trouble, like if we're getting clumped up in front of the restaurant, feel free to spread out, but also like don't block the entrances to the neighboring restaurants or businesses either. With that said, I want to introduce our first speaker, Alyssa, the co-chair of Jobs with Justice in Portland.
Alyssa! Yeah. When I say Jobs with, you say Justice, Jobs with!
Justice!
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 We are not kidding about Jobs with Justice.
Low-wage work for a long time has been regarded as something that is supposed to consign you to poverty forever.
Boo!
That if you work in fast food, it's okay to be treated like by your manager.
Boo!
That it's okay for you to get poverty wages and you better not say anything.
Boo!
Because we all know too often that bootlickers who work for these places will tell you that it's good that you even have a job and you shouldn't be complaining. Those people need to stay on the ground, keep licking boots, and stop talking to us!
Yeah.
All work deserves to be compensated at a fair wage with a collective bargaining contract. We are going to get it!
Yeah.
Off now to our LBU member and worker. Yeah, here we go.
I work at the Little Big Burger. I work in a couple minutes, actually. So I'll keep it brief. I've been here for 2 years. You know, I've been working jobs like this all my life, and I never thought that anything like this could happen. Sticking this out with my coworkers has been like such a life-changing and transformative thing for me. Delivering a letter to our manager telling them that they have to recognize our demands, that they are gonna have to deal with us and have to listen to us. I've ever done. And I'm so excited and like cannot be happier to be doing it with these people. Anyone else wanna talk?
Jimmy!
Hi, this is Jimmy from the Bergamo Workers Union.
Hey, folks!
Hey, wow. Jimmy!
Wow, what a big deal!
Yeah.
It's the Little Big Union!
Yeah!
So you guys know how long I've been waiting for this? My name is Jimmy, and I'm the rank and file member of the Burgerville Workers Union.
Yeah.
The Burgerville Workers Union, if you haven't heard, has been affiliated since day one with the Industrial Workers of the World, also known as the IWW, which is the same union that workers at Little Big Burger are now joining today.
Yeah!
Let me share some fun facts. The IWW is an international, anti-capitalist, anti-racist labor union that has been around for over 100 years. Members of the IWW are affectionately known as Wobblies. And throughout the last 100 years, Wobblies have led the way in militant worker struggle against fascism and the capitalist system. Over the past few years, here in Portland, Oregon, Wobblies have been making history again by organizing the only fast food union in the country. And today, Wobblies are making history yet again by going public with the second fast food union in the country, Little Big Union! Do you guys know how long I have been waiting for this? For years now, we had been alone as the only fast food union in the country. Sure, not completely alone. We've had help from so many people. The Carpenters, Jobs with Justice, the Northwest Workers Justice Project, the Democratic Socialists of America, the IWW International, and so many, many more. But until today, there has been no other open community of rank and file fast food workers organizing their own union. I have been waiting for this day for years, and I am so ecstatic to be here to witness it, because today we are no longer alone. Today we get to welcome our fellow fast food workers at Little Big Burger into the one big union.
Yeah.
And look, when Little Big Burger workers first thought about organizing a union 2 years ago, they reached out to several other unions and found that the only ones willing to help them organize were the IWW. And hey, it's been this way for 100 years. Because since our founding, we've always been willing to organize those deemed unorganizable. So long as you're not a boss or a cop, you're allowed to join the IWW. Are you white, black, unemployed, a prisoner, a sex worker, a fast food worker? It doesn't matter. You're in the working class and you have a place in the one big union. Now, okay, having said that, I do need to come clean a bit. We in the Burgerville Workers Union are just regular people, okay? We're just workers and students, and that's mainly it. Some of us are unemployed, struggling to find a job. We don't have a lot of resources. And the IWW internationally is a comparatively small union with comparatively few resources as well. We here at Portland today have managed to make history twice, because we have something more powerful than money, something freely exchanged that grows the more it is shared. What I'm talking about is solidarity. Yeah. Solidarity is at the core of what we do in the IWW. Solidarity is the fundamental essence of working class power. Solidarity means love and common commitment. It means recognizing each other in our common need and suffering. And it means that when things get tough, we stand together, because an injury to one is an injury to all. Yeah, so let me be frank with you. What workers need to do is go on strike. For those of you who don't know, a strike is when workers withhold their labor in order to gain leverage against the boss. 2018 saw the highest amount of strikes in the United States in around 30 years. Teachers all across the country have been going on huge strikes and winning! Yeah. Airport workers went on strike and ended Trump's government shutdown. And Burgerville workers have gone on several historic strikes over the years, which have built our power every time. Imagine if we, the workers, were the ones in charge. Everything will belong to everybody. Yeah! Just look. Love and solidarity are at the core of what we do. Never forget that. When you stand up for yourself, you will be told that you are being violent or that you are being rude. Your bosses will say this to you as they hire armed guards to harass and intimidate you. I am speaking from experience. And while I'm on the subject, Burgerville has been union busting at the Convention Center Burgerville. Shame on Burgerville. All right, I don't know if you heard, but they filed for an election, and now they're disciplining people left and right. So please, give Burgerville Corporate a call. There's information on our Facebook page. You can just call and be like, hey, I see that you're union busting, cut it out, and then you can hang up, okay? That's all you gotta say, that's all you gotta do. When you stand up for yourselves, you are expressing love and solidarity for one another and for all of the living world. It is the boss who is violent and who will stop at nothing to prevent you from realizing a better world. So from one fast food worker to another, love each other and hold each other up as you struggle for liberation. And I really have to add, it is our duty to stand in solidarity with the international working class. Stand in solidarity with the people of Venezuela suffering from U.S. imperialism. Yeah. Yeah. Stand in solidarity with Palestine suffering from Israeli apartheid. Yeah. Stand in solidarity with refugees being abused in ICE concentration camps. Yeah. The working class in Portland has more in common with the working class in China or in the Philippines than it does with the capitalist class here in Portland. When we say one big union of the working class, we mean one big union of the working class. Welcome to the union, everybody.
After these speeches, members of the LBU, IWW, Portland Socialist Alternative, Burgerville employees, and community supporters all marched together to a Little Big Burger location in Northwest Portland to hand in their letter of demands. I was able to join the LBU members as they walked into the location and declared their demands to management.
Dear Little Big Burger, We, the workers employed by Little Big Burger, are excited to announce that we have formed the Little Big Union in affiliation with the industrial workers of the world. We are LBB line cooks, grill cooks, fry cooks, prep cooks, cashiers, dishwashers, bussers, custodians. We are committed to our jobs and to doing them well. We are committed to being part and parcel of the LBB family. We ask that LBB make the same commitment to us. We come to you in hopes of establishing a collective bargaining relationship, enabling us to cooperate in mutual pursuit of a safer, healthier, and more comfortable work environment for all Little Big Burger employees. We request that you recognize Little Big Union as a legitimate representative of all Little Big Burger full-time and regular part-time associates, including those working teachers. We wish to bargain collectively on behalf of these workers and to reach agreement on fair wages, reasonable hours, and decent conditions of employment. Here are our requests, simple and straightforward.
Neutrality and non-disparagement. So we have organized to make our workplace better, not because we believe LBB is bad. We have nothing negative to say about the company. We hope you have no desire to disparage your own workers and their own union because of their decision to organize. We ask for a written signed commitment to non-disparagement and neutrality. We request respect and fair deal. We ask that LBB and all its representatives demonstrate respect for our decision to organize by not hiring union busters, not engaging in union busting yourself, no captive audience meetings, no anti-union literature, no opposition to employees who want simply to exercise fundamental human rights to bargain collectively. Not spying on or interrogating workers about union activities or membership.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, March 18th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen Dogma. This screening benefits Not Okay PDX. Again, that's Dogma showing Monday, March 18th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage, under Community Events.
All right. Good evening. This is Labor Radio. I am your host, Michael Cathcart. Thank you for joining me on this beautiful, sunny evening. Before